Okay, so I will talk about dense frontal lobe nodes, and that means also quasi-static. I should have written quasi-static here, and that is totally different from that what Jim talked about now. So we are not talking about the granular temperature, the particles rattling around, colliding with each other. They are just sitting in the box. You will see that in a second. And the empty white area, there should be all the colleagues which helped me with this work.
This won't be recorded.
Oh, that's good. Nobody knows what I said.
Now everybody in 10 years can still recognize if I say something wrong.
Okay, you have read already this, so I don't have to go on this. But anyway, there are a lot of realistic materials, powders, whatever, wheat, starch, and we will focus on model granular materials now. There are also attempts to do that, what I show you today, also for realistic materials. Okay, but today, model materials there, I hope the understanding is easier, the understanding process, and I will talk mostly about friction and cohesion effects and anisotropy, as the title states. The pictures like the stress force chains in the experiments from Berenger et al. Or footsteps in dunes, that is something which you all know. Localization in shear bands, force chains I mentioned already, segregation I will not talk about today, and we will see a lot of shear bands today. So the philosophy of the talk is I neglect what goes on within single particles, then I define particle contact properties, then I go to many particle simulations, and then at the end I will talk about steps to go to a continuum theory. And all these steps we try to have experimental accompaniment and experimental foundations. So first, the particle contact interactions, they are measured, or at least some of the particle contact properties are measured with atomic force microscopy. We glue some spherical particles on a cantilever of an atomic force microscope. We put the particles on the surface of the wafer, and then we can press particles together. That is done by the group in Mainz, in the Polymer Institute. And what you get then is the adhesion force as a function of the load. Four different sets of materials and four different compression load. And what you see, the adhesion force, that is the force which is needed if you put two particles together, the force which is needed to pull them off again. So that are, we think of micrometer particles now, so the van der Waals forces are very strong, so you have to come over that. Yes? Well, there are two possibilities. Either you temperature glue it, or you have a very small fiddly type of glue, which is first put on the cantilever, and then the cantilever just takes the sphere. And then you have to control if you really have taken it. Okay. Hopefully, yes. Okay, but if you would use soft polymer, then it could wander around the sphere. That happened, but the people which do that, they try to avoid that naturally. Okay, one of the findings of these experiments is that for polystyrene and for glass, you have these two different types of behavior. What you see is the hysteresis. The polystyrene is quite soft. If you press it, you keep a permanent deformation at the contact area. And for glass, we don't find that. So that is the slope here, and that is the horizontal, what you should read. In order to put that into the computer simulations, which I will show you next, that is force against displacement in the computer simulations. Unfortunately, this, we still did not succeed to get one of these curves experimentally. There are experimental problems, adjustment problems. So what we have is, we have for loading, it starts at zero force, then we load and the force increases linearly, and then when we unload, we follow the other line, the steeper line. And the from the point here to zero, that is the plastic deformation. If we go to negative forces, that is the adhesion force, and the F min, that is the maximum adhesion force. That is the pull-off force, which can be measured by the experiment. And so the plastic deformation and the pull-off force are inserted in the computer simulations this way. And that's naturally too simple, you see it. Okay, with this, we go to many particle simulation. And many particle simulations mean 10,000 to 1 million particles. Industrial scale applications are much too large for this. So finite element will still be industrial practice. Finite element relies on constitutive relations. And that is the step now, micro-macro or homogenization, however you call it. We want to learn from our small particle simulations how to describe the material on a macroscopic way, in a macroscopic way. And that is more the idea. Yes?
I mean, people have done a lot of quasi-static simulations.
Yes.
Normally, with even more naive models for the particle interaction. It would just make it a little easier for me if you just said a word about your motivation in doing this type of study.
Okay, micrometer particles. So we have van der Waals forces, we have cohesion. And with cohesion, there's not so much done. That was the cohesion. And the friction, we are confident that we have the right friction model and we vary friction. So and in the simulation, always you can systematically vary and then let the simulation, for example, run 10 times, 20 times slower. So the motivation was in 2001, I did the first simulations and then I did them 2 times slower. It takes longer. And the simulations I show you today are 20 times slower than the simulations which I did in 2001. And then a set of data needs 4 months, also on a single processor. So that is the history of motivation behind. You read this, meanwhile, you know discrete element method. Mass times acceleration is force. Momentum of inertia times angular acceleration is torque. And forces are coupling this set of equations for all particles, and we have to solve this. This is the simulation. I show you the results in a moment. For friction, we have sliding degrees of freedom, which are which are hindered by friction. We also have rolling degrees of freedom and torsion degrees of freedom in 3 dimensions. But I don't talk about this today too much. For the rolling degrees of freedom, I mean, this is an hourglass. The hourglass, this is the upper box. The particles will fall out here, and then they enter to the lower box of the hourglass. So the left simulation is a simulation of spheres in 3D with friction, and the right simulation is a no cohesion yet. The right simulation includes a small rolling friction, rolling resistance, and the difference is with friction through this opening the particles go out, with rolling friction they pluck. So the rolling friction which we insert is just thought to mimic a very small surface roughness of the particles, of the realistic particles which we have in mind. So we can switch that on, change it. It makes not so much sense to go too high rolling resistance. And it does not save us from doing polymers if we have, polygons. It does not save us from doing polygons if we have polygonal particles, like sand grains. They are not definitely not spheres. Okay, now, having the simulations, I show you some results. For this opening, for this particles, for this friction coefficient, yes. But not only. No, if I change the opening, it will not plug anymore. If I may make the opening smaller, then it will plug. It was 3 grains, actually. But it was not a rotation symmetric. It was a lengthy one. And that... Okay, so the answer is clear. Yes, no. Yes, so for the simulations, I will not do a simple shear simulation because I don't like that geometry. Simple shear, the strain tensor looks like this. That's the superposition of a rotation and the symmetric shear. And the green and the orange arrows are compression and tension directions. Instead, I take the simple shear, the symmetric shear tensor, and rotate it by 45 degrees. And then I have a diagonal tensor, which is traceless, so no volume change. And it's a plus and a minus shear direction. So that is the biaxial shear. And when I say shear, I can also say deviatoric shear or biaxial shear. And I mean this biaxial one and not the shear one which you might have in mind. Okay, this is the geometry. We move the top wall in and we keep the side wall pressure controlled. And this is how the results look like then. The blue lines are the walls. the particles are color-coded. The blue particles don't feel strong forces. The green and red particles feel strong forces. The black particles don't feel any force. That are these rattlers which are sitting around in the packing, and I could take them out and that would not change anything. So at the beginning, we try to set it up isotropically. All directions are equally represented. Then, after 1% of deformation, you see color change. That means we have compression. We have higher stresses. We have smaller volume. And you also see that the lines are mostly vertical now. And that is the anisotropy in the structure, which immediately comes. Anisotropy in structure and stress, which you see already after very small deformations. That is why I talk about anisotropy today. And if you deform stronger, then you get shear band localization, which you don't really see very well in this, which you won't believe me if I only show you this, but I show you some more evidence for this in a second. In the animation, it looks like this. Yes? Well, the initial condition has, I start with zero strain relative to the initial condition, but the initial condition is under predefined stress, isotropic stress. And I can vary the isotropic initial stress. 0.83 to 0.85 in 2D. For V, I didn't mention that, 0.5 0.5 larger than the mean value of size distribution. So it's an equal probability distribution between the maxima. Okay, here you see really the shear band. You see the fluctuations, enormous fluctuations, and also fingers of kinetic energy moving in the still areas left and right of the shear band. Yes. And for symmetry reasons, I fix the lower left walls, and I only control here. And since I do it quasi-static, the pressure here is equal to the pressure there. If I do it dynamically, then if I do it faster, then this is not true anymore. Okay.
Actually, you just said this, but remarkable. There's an isotropic stuff.
At the beginning. You will see in a second that after small deformation, it's anisotropic already.
Then I don't understand. What is your criterion for how fast you move the sidewall?
No, the sidewall is a stress. The sigma xx is constant. Okay. But the sigma zz is adjusted by the particles.
And you move down at a constant velocity, and the force on that wall is whatever it chooses.
Yes.
And the force on the other wall is kept constant.
Yes. Okay, that was kinetic energy, and here you see rotations of the particles. So in the green area here, the particles are not rotating, and in the shear band, red particles are rotating clockwise, blue particles are rotating counterclockwise. So this is the phenomenology of what we see from this, from a representative simulation. Now, in the typical engineering experiment, yes? No, only friction here. If 0.5, 2D, yes. If I insert small rolling resistance, the picture doesn't change. I didn't do big rolling resistance because that should avoid that easy arrangement. Okay, if I would do an experiment, then I could not look inside. But what I could get from an experiment, and what geotechnics people typically get from the experiment, is volumetric strain as a function of the deformation of the upper wall, and stress as a function of the upper wall deformation. So negative means we have compression at the beginning, and then we have dilatancy, and then we have steady state shear flow. That is when the shear band has evolved. The shear band starts to evolve around here. Stress increases. The vertical stress increases. The horizontal stress stays more or less constant. It has some reaction time, so it's not perfectly constant. And after some peak stress, we get softening and critical state flow at a lower stress level. That is what a typical simulation tells us. And when you, for example, now want to really go to continuum theory, a very simple continuum theory would involve the Poisson ratio. The Poisson ratio you get from volume strain against vertical strain from the initial slope. And the interesting thing is, for different confining pressures, the Poisson ratio for this data set was constant, was the same. For other data sets, we get other values between 0.3 and 0.8. In 2D, you can have Poisson ratios up to 1. In 3D, you should have Poisson ratios only to 0.5. Have I? No, initially I don't have plastic deformation. For the very initial slope. Pardon?
You have sliding already.
Not for 10 to the power minus. Yes, sure. But for 10 to the power minus 7 strain, I don't have sliding yet.
Oh, well, yeah, but I mean, you have a straight line there that's wrapped up to 0.003, as you said. So that certainly accounts for
this one.
The effects of plastic.
Yes, every deviation from the straight line is plastic. But the initial state.
So this means the total percentage is not the analytic effect on the it's an incremental weapon.
The signal is incremental. The straight line is the fit to the initial elastic response. Okay. Then there's also dilatancy. And what that tells you, this dilatancy angle is it's small for high confining pressure and it's large for small confining pressure. So if you have high stress, which tries to avoid dilatancy, then you have a small dilatancy angle. So qualitatively that makes sense. And from the stress strain curve, you get the modulus from the initial slope, and the data which you are seeing differently here, following the pink arrow, that is weak cohesion or no cohesion for the lower lines and increasing cohesion going up for large and small confining stress, which changes qualitatively the picture. The arrows indicate the peak stress, and the peak stress I can plot in these Mohr circle type of things. The peak stress. What does the Mohr circle mean? The left point, that is the confining stress. And the right point of one of these circles, that's the peak stress. And that is the nice thing about the biaxial box. I know where my eigensystem of the box is, and that is why I can easily plot such circles. So the inner circle is no cohesion. The outer circles are increasing cohesion. The large confining stress and the small confining stress correspond to these sets of circles. And if I now put tangents to circles for the same cohesion values, then I get straight lines with a slope of 13 degrees, which is with a slope which corresponds to 13 degrees. And this is what continuum theory people and experimentalists name as the friction angle of the material. And we don't have friction microscopically here. That's the interesting thing. But we still get a macroscopic friction angle because the particles, the frictionless particles in this simulation, are interlocked. And that leads to a shear resistance, and that is what the slope means. Okay, and the other set of continuum quantity which I get out is the cohesion. That is the intersection with the vertical axis, with the shear stress axis. And the cohesion, we get the data from the points from the simulation, and that was disappointing because I have more or less a piecewise linear model, so I expected to see something linear here. But then after some reconsideration, we found out that the cohesion is proportional to the pull-off force, which I put in the model. And the pull-off force, that's nice, the pull-off force we also get from the experiments. So the macroscopic cohesion, which you can measure with these standard geotechnics experiments, can now be related to a microscopic force. And that's one of the, I think, partial success. Partial, because there's still a constant which depends on a lot of other parameters. Yes? Yes, you see one in a second. This one. So this is now no cohesion, but with friction. That microscopic friction increases the slope. And no cohesion means that we also get no macroscopic cohesion out of the model. Okay, and there's a small difference between the microscopic friction angle and the macroscopic friction angle always. Yes? Yes. In the case of, in this case, yes. In the other case, no. This one? KC is Okay, in the triangle.
Which what about the Roma eccentricity of Cupid? Because why for here? I believe there are more equal. There are no equal.
I don't care, actually, because this is the model which I put in. And actually, I have in mind spheres always. So I don't care really about disks. In the simulations, I use something two-dimensional. But also in the simulations, I can use the mass of a sphere instead of the mass of a disk. But that doesn't matter, because mass is not important in the quasi-static simulations. So I think of spheres. And also the experiments which we look at always are spherical-like particles and not disks. So I don't care about the disk argument in the moment. But I don't understand it, so we have to talk about that afterwards. Yes?
From the experiment with no friction, I don't understand why we get the macroscopic friction condition. Is it the maximum friction?
Yes, it's peak.
It's peak, so it is a
dynamic. Yeah, and it's two-dimensional. In three dimensions, the friction coefficient is much smaller. And for critical state flow, it's maybe even smaller. Assume I take soap with my fingers, and still I will have problems to shear them. And what is friction? It's shear resistance.
That's the dilatancy effect.
Yes, but you see that. What is friction? Macroscopic friction is a
shear.
No, because I still have particles which are interacting, and if I delay it and move them, then new particles will interfere. Yes, but in critical state flow, it only means that you don't have dilation anymore. But you still can have shear resistance. That's one of the points which we should discuss. Okay, now, increasing friction, microscopic friction, you will agree with this at least, increases the dilatancy, and it also increases the peak stress values for both peak stress and for critical state stress value. Okay, and if you summarize all this, then you get the friction coefficient, macroscopic friction coefficient as a function of the microscopic friction coefficient with the steady state values much smaller than the peak stress values, which I get from the peak stress. And the two different symbols are different preparation modes. So for the peak stress, I get a sensitivity on the preparation procedure. And for the steady state shear, I don't get sensitivity on the preparation procedure as it should be. So that is the message. The other message is I don't understand the functional behavior here. Now, a few words about continuum theory. You could now take the parameters which I derived, which I read off from the simulation, in a finite element code with micropolar elements. So the rotations are also in the shear bend localized. Teichmann did something like that. Not exactly with my parameters. We are trying to do that. And then you can do a finite element simulation. Now, the last 1.5 minutes, I have to talk about anisotropy. And we have seen these plots already, and I want to show you the anisotropy evolution of stress. And anisotropy of stress means we go from a isotropic stress to a stress which is almost three times, to a vertical stress which is almost three times higher than the initial stress. And this is anisotropy in this is anisotropy in stress. And the interesting finding is that these simulations, many simulations, confirm or follow this differential equation. And the differential equation just means that the stress exponentially approaches the maximum. And this was also found by experimentalists. And this is something which allows me now to look at two parameters. The one is the maximum stress magnitude, dependent on the parameters. And the other one is the beta, which is practically the corresponding modulus of my experiment. So the modulus is a function of density, of pressure, of friction coefficient, and the S-max I don't understand yet. So this is where we have to look at. And okay, now you say, okay, coincidence and exponential approach that allows nice modeling, maybe, but it's more than coincidence, I believe, because stress anisotropy, that is nothing very fascinating, but structural anisotropy, that is what I mentioned at the beginning, that is more hard evidence for real anisotropy and remaining anisotropy. So in this biaxial box, we compress vertically. The vertical modulus increases very rapidly and then levels out at a value which is larger than the horizontal modulus, and the shear modulus is lower and doesn't change much. So that is the message from this set of simulations, including friction, including cohesion, both not too extreme, and we only have three moduli. Isotropic elastic theory would have two moduli, so we only have one more. We could have three more, but we only find one significant. Yes? Oh, that takes longer. I would like to explain that after. And no, it doesn't come here. I hoped it would come. No, I would need 5 minutes and then my talk is over. Okay, now the point is the anisotropy, which is the difference of the vertical and the horizontal modulus. That follows the same differential equation. It also approaches exponentially the maximum. And this now, I think, is evidence that there must be something behind. The stress exponentially approaches the maximum. The anisotropy also exponentially approaches the maximum. So there must be something behind. Unfortunately, the parameters which we have here, I cannot see yet that they have to do something with each other. They behave differently. Now, continuum theory, you can reformulate all the parameters, all the moduli, and write something down which is scalar for the biaxial box, only for the biaxial box. That is volumetric stress. Isotropic stress change is a function of the bulk modulus and the volume change of the system. There's a coupling of the deviatoric strain via the anisotropic modulus, and the deviatoric stress change is coupled to the volumetric strain via the anisotropic modulus also, and there's a shear modulus in this very simple writing. And if you assume isotropy, then you lose everything, and everything looks trivial then at the end of the day. This is the biaxial box, and there I know that my eigensystems are fixed to the Cartesian coordinate. If I do that for arbitrary eigensystem, then it looks a little bit more complicated, and the orientations of the structure, the orientations of the strain, interfere with each other. Okay. And the open questions, which I still have, is a quantitative experimental verification. Together with Bob, we have done it in the Coetzee experiment, and we found quantitative up to 80% or 70%, however you would classify that, agreement. For powder, fine powder, where cohesion is very important, we are not that far yet. Okay, and the main challenge is also this, carrying out this micro-macro transition, and for example, calculating these moduli, and the constitutive modeling at the end of the day. And there are hundreds of constitutive models, and I was naive, and I'm still naive. I believe none of the constitutive models on the market will do the job. Maybe combinations of it. Maybe we find one which does the job to describe granular materials always. And okay, I don't talk about all the other issues. I only show you for the questions the three-dimensional animation. The color code is the same as in the two-dimensional one, and you can look inside if you take particles away. These are the particles which feel weak forces. They are homogeneously distributed. Okay, and three dimensions is the next thing. So I try to get all that what I showed you in two dimensions. Now we try to get it in three dimensions, and then we can compare it to powders, to real systems. Okay, thank you.
I think a couple of quick questions because we have to go on to the next one.
After a shear band develops, do we understand that then you're measuring the properties within the shear band?
That's another project. That was the Couette. Because the disadvantage of the biaxial box, I don't know where the shear band is. The shear band jumps and moves. In the Couette, I know it's always at the inner wall and I can measure it there.
Have you by any chance looked at the force distributions of, say, under, say, compression versus shear and so forth, the contact forces?
Yes, in the isotropic case, we looked at the force distributions for different stresses, for example, and we tried to fit, for example, this Gaussian-like correction to the exponential decay, and yes, it's not satisfying. I don't have a close picture to tell. And in the anisotropic case, I didn't look at, because then you should do direction-resolved force distributions, right. And I didn't have time for that yet.
Okay.